From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it's another wild day on Wall Street. After the Dow dropped more than 1,000 points yesterday, the second time that happened this week. But many are trying to calm fears. Here's Ron Kruszewski, CEO of Stifel Financial, speaking on CNBC.
I'm confident that there's no recession coming, and I believe the market will be higher at the end of the year. We're going to go through some volatility patches here. But look, I think this is an opportunity for investors to make some money. It's hard to buy stocks in times like this.
Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's happening? Are we going to keep seeing these big drops, or are investors going to start to maybe think that it's a deal and buy back in?
Well, I think the consensus assessment on Wall Street is that we will see a rebound from this, just because the outlook for the economy and the outlook for corporate profits are still so bright. Now, that said, there are few phrases on Wall Street that make people more nervous than consensus assessment, like I just said, just because the collective wisdom isn't always right. Seen a lot of investors and traders earlier in the week saying the worst is over, you know, and it just keeps getting worse. I think for most investors, the main concern is inflation and interest rates. And we have obviously have a new chair of the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell. Mm-hmm. There's some questions about exactly how he will respond to this, if he might possibly put interest rate increases on hold or continue full steam ahead with them. So this upcoming March meeting of the Fed is going to be especially important.
So maybe they'll call this the Powell correction. people are calling this a market correction now. That means it's down 10% from a recent high. Now, that is not so unusual. The last S&P correction was in 2016. There were two in 2015. There was one in 2011, 2010, 2007. So do they just happen from time to time? We shouldn't worry?
They did, or at least I should say they did. They used to. What's unusual about this market is we went so long without any real noticeable retreat in the stock market. Before this, it wasn't since the Brexit vote in the summer of 2016 that we saw a noticeable dip in the stock market. What's unusual about this one is how fast it occurred. I mean, this is looking like the worst week on Wall Street, down almost 8% in the S&P 500. It's the worst week since really the height of the financial crisis in 2008. So it's shocking to see that come out of the blue like this.
But that's another interesting point, which is that the financial crisis was so bad. I mean, it was the worst in decades, the recession that came then. Even if we were to go into another recession, it's unlikely it would be as bad as the one we just had.
Yeah, I think that's probably, again, a safe consensus assessment.
Which may be wrong. But,
right. It could be wrong. I mean, that's a lot of the smartest people out there right now are trying to figure out sort of the link between this stock market sell-off and the economy. Will it hurt confidence? Will it hurt sort of that wealth effect that the stock market creates? And will that weigh on consumer spending and that sort of thing and corporate investment? And, you know, it's hard to say at the moment, obviously, and obviously a sharp rebound would ease those concerns. But it's a big open question at the moment.
One of the images that we keep seeing when the market drops like this is these traders on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange smacking their heads. But in fact, a lot of the trading that has led to these big drops has been done electronically, right? How much is computerized trading leading to what we're seeing?
Well, obviously, you can't trade a stock without a computer anymore. And, you know, there is a ton of sort of automated trading. The big thing that happened this week, it's very hard to explain without getting too technical, but I sort of think of it as the weather. You know, the market had been so calm, so sunny for so long that a lot of sophisticated investors started basically selling insurance on the stock market at very cheap prices because they didn't think anything like this was on the horizon. Mm. So, you know, it's like being an insurance company selling cheap property insurance and then having a tropical storm come in and not being prepared for the losses. So a lot of the ripple effects that have happened in the market is a reaction to this sudden uptick in volatility. And, you know, if you weren't selling insurance, a lot of strategies were sort of aggressively more buying stocks more aggressively right. than they would otherwise because of this sort of calm atmosphere that had prevailed.
Mike, just a few seconds left, but another big story in the business world today, a settlement in Silicon Valley. Uber has agreed to give about $245 million worth of stock to Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, and the self-driving car unit Waymo, which had accused Uber of stealing self-driving car technology. What's been the reaction?
Well, I think, you know, it's a fascinating case and it's a big sort of dramatic story in Silicon Valley. $245 million to either one of these companies is not that big of a deal. Waymo was seeking $1.9 billion right. and in order to prevent Uber from using the technology. So, it's settled and I guess Uber's probably pretty happy that they only had to pay that much.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The second government shutdown of the year lasted less than 6 hours, the shortest one since the 1970s. But that was plenty of time for people around the country to jump on social media and regale us with their expertise, because it's 2018 and hashtag everyone's an expert. Femi Okay is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and she joins us now from Washington. Hi there, Femi.
Hello there.
Okay, so how did people talk about the shutdown online?
Exhaustion. Here we go again. And this one from Citizens Outpost. The US government shut down and reopened while you were sleeping. And that was posted above a picture of the Republican Rand Paul looking very stoic. But if you want to stay on message, look at Speaker Paul Ryan's Twitter feed. And there you will see, this is a great victory for our men and women in uniform. We ultimately reached a bipartisan compromise that fully funds our troops.
Well, you mentioned Rand Paul there, Senator Rand Paul. There were a lot of people reacting to him in particular because he did indeed vote for the GOP tax cut plan, which sizably increased the national deficit, but then held up that Senate vote last night to complain about the deficit that this budget would create. So what were people saying about that?
Well, each of that what now seems to be regular shutdowns, they're labelled as somebody's name. So it was the Chuck Schumer shutdown, and now this one has been known as the Rand Paul shutdown. Owning it.
So let's move on to the world of reality television there then now.
Also politics, bizarrely enough.
Yeah, I was going to say, this one's, we're not leaving politics because, I don't know, politics and reality TV are awfully close these days, because we have Omarosa Manigault back in the news talking about her time in the White House.
We missed her. It's been minutes.
She was, because she's got this new gig, right? A contestant on Celebrity Big Brother. We have a little tape here. She's answering questions from other contestants about working for President Trump.
Does anybody say to him, what are you doing?
I mean, I tried to be that person, and then all of the people around him attacked me. Was like, keep her away from, don't give her access.
Femi, how are people reacting to this? People are going nuts. Basically, pull up your screen, get some popcorn, and sit down and enjoy Twitter exploding over this. Brian Pereca from The Hollywood Reporter says, here we go. At Omarosa starts talking at real Donald Trump in her return to reality TV career. That's where they first met, of course. She says, countries should be worried. Quote here, it's not going to be okay. It's not. It's so bad. Now, the debate, Meghna, online is really, is Omarosa acting? Is she telling the truth? Are we really getting our news about the President of the United States from Celebrity Big Brother? Or is this all just drama? And that question will go on as Celebrity Big Brother goes on.
It could be all of the above, right?
All of the above. Everything. Because it's 2018. And there's not a fine line between reality TV and our current political situation.
Oh, dear. Okay, so let's move on to another story. This one is genuinely unrelated to politics, and I want to end Friday. I have a good news here on Friday, because Gerber has a new spokesbaby for 2018, 18-month-old named Lucas. He has Down syndrome, and he'll be featured on Gerber's social media pages throughout the year. What's been the response to seeing Lucas be the Gerber baby?
If you haven't seen Lucas yet, look him up. Lucas Warren, he is so photogenic. congratulations to Gerber, because they obviously picked a baby that lights up the screen. You look at his face, you can't resist but smile. He's popping up all over people's social feeds. Kim Richards on Twitter summed it up perfectly. This is a huge positive response from online, mostly. Finally, something on Twitter, Kim says, that doesn't make me want to take a day off life.
I've just pulled his picture up here. He is absolutely adorable. There's one photograph of him in a little bow tie with a smile that could literally light up
it's
the room.
A beautiful baby. Lots of praise, of course, including this one from the Global Down Syndrome Foundation. On Twitter, they posted a picture of Lucas, and it's a split frame with the iconic Gerber baby. And then, I mean, you look at them both, they look like twinsies, basically. But more importantly, here's what the post said. A huge congrats to the incredible Lucas, the first Gerber baby with Down syndrome since the contest started in 1920. Everybody's calling him precious, adorable, sweetie. But parents of Down syndrome children are pointing out that Gerber insurance, obviously linked to the company, doesn't always cover Down syndrome children, pointing that out. And maybe with the spokesbaby being Lucas and having Down syndrome, perhaps this might just change things.
Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Take care.
Music playing at a welcoming ceremony before the official opening ceremony for the 23rd Winter Olympics today. We're not allowed to play sound yet from the opening ceremony because it hasn't yet been broadcast in the United States. NPR's Russell Lewis was there. He joins us from South Korea. Hi, Russell.
Hey there.
And Vice President Mike Pence is there. He was seated quite close to Kim Jong-un's sister during the opening ceremony, but it doesn't look like they spoke with each other.
No, in fact, he was sitting literally one row away from the North Korean delegation, just a few seats away, in fact. And everything that we've heard and seen is that they did not talk, didn't say anything, probably didn't even acknowledge each other.
And we'll be watching to see if they do at any point during the games. But meanwhile, the opening ceremonies, they've happened. You were there. They haven't been broadcast in the U.S. yet. But what were they like?
The opening ceremony of any Olympics is a special thing. And I think it was particularly special this time because, you know, really there's always this theme of togetherness and peace. But, you know, certainly that had a very specific meaning this time. There were really some pretty striking symbolic moments. Of course, Kim Jong-un's sister was there, as we mentioned, you know, in this rare appearance with the South. She actually shook hands with the South Korean president as the unified North-South team marched into the stadium. You know, the flag that they were jointly carrying, there was one member of the South, one member of the North were jointly carrying the flag as they marched into the stadium. The flag was white and it was the entire Korean peninsula. And it was just a nice moment. You could see the people from the North and the South were walking in and happy, and it was just, you know, it was just nicely done. And, you know, the final torch moment, one member from the North and one member from the South were climbing these stairs to pass the torch to be lit. And again, it was just, you know, it was just a nice moment of togetherness.
There was some controversy about which American Olympian would lead the team and carry the flag. Aaron Hamlin was chosen over Shawnee Davis with a coin toss. What happened?
Well, I mean, that's kind of as much as we know. You know, Aaron Hamlin, of course, this is her fourth and final Olympics. She was overjoyed to carry the torch. You know, was finding it difficult to sort of put it into words when she met with the press after, you know, the announcement that she was going to be doing it. Shawnee Davis felt that, he was the right one to be holding the flag on the way in. And for whatever reason, it just didn't work out. So, you know, there's always a little bit of drama in any Olympics. And that's the drama that there is at the moment.
There are 242 athletes competing for the United States, which we read is the largest delegation any country has ever sent to a Winter Games.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing. And certainly, you know, not all of them marched, in the opening ceremony, but certainly you could tell that it was, you know, one of the largest delegations there sort of coming in. And the United States is, you know, always dominant in any Olympics. You know, they've been better at the summer than in the winter, but they've fielding this larger team and hoping that they can do better this time around.
We've been following your tweets and the NPR team's tweets there in South Korea. And Melissa Block seems to be upset that it's too cold. How's the weather?
When we first got here a couple of days ago, you know, the lows were in the negative single digits. You know, the highs were getting up into the single digits and into the teens. And today in Pyeongchang, it was into the 20s. And I have to say, when you've been in the single digits, the 20s feels downright balmy.
Right.
It's supposed to warm up here for a little bit over the next couple of days. But they're talking about the possibility of a little bit of snow in a week's time. So the temperature's not too bad, but it's certainly playing into its name of being the Winter Olympics, because it definitely is winter here.
So what will you be looking forward to this weekend in competition?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this weekend, I mean, the marquee event that we're all looking forward to is the men's downhill on Sunday. You know, it is one of the key events, and it's the fastest where the skiers will go down 90 miles an hour down the mountain. It's a pretty fearful kind of thing. And that's going to be the marquee event of this weekend.
You know, one of the storylines at almost every Olympics these days is that they spend all this money in the host country, they build all this infrastructure, and then there's always a question about whether they can actually sell the tickets that they need. What's it like in terms of the crowd there in South Korea?
Well, you know, I mean, the one thing that they'll always sell out is always the open and the closing ceremonies. That is always, you know, one of the highest demands. It's always some of the highest tickets. You know, I think really what you're interested in is looking into sort of as the games wear on, looking into the stadiums and seeing just how full that they are. You know, initially they were talking about that the ticket sales were a bit disappointing. They hadn't quite reached the levels that they had hoped. But we'll have to see, you know, how that turns around as the games go on.
You were in Rio for the Olympics. How does this compare to that one?
Well, it's definitely a little bit colder.
Right.
You know, there's a world of difference between the Winter Olympics and the Summer Olympics. Certainly, you know, I mean, the most striking thing to us and to our team here is, you know, from a logistics standpoint, that things are running very, very smoothly here in South Korea as compared to what we saw in Brazil. Not a criticism of Brazil. It's just that, you know, you can tell that they put a tremendous amount of preparation into it here in South Korea. The buses are running all on time. They show up when they're supposed to show up. And there just haven't been the issues that we were sort of wrestling with in Brazil.
That's NPR's Russell Lewis joining us from South Korea, where the Olympics are getting underway. Russell, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, if hearing about the Olympics makes you want to get out there and do some backcountry skiing yourself, maybe it's time for a trip to the mountains and forests of Vermont, where a nonprofit organization is trying to make it easier for people to enjoy outdoor activities by creating a trailside network of all-season cabins. Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck has more.
R.J. Thompson walks across a snowy parking lot at the Yestermorrow Design and Build School in Waitsfield, Vermont.
There it is. That's our first hut.
Thompson is executive director of the Vermont Huts Association, and he points to a compact wood cabin stained a striking red.
Wow, the color's really distinctive.
Yeah, I think it's going to look really incredible during foliage season.
When he gave me a tour in December, students were putting the finishing touches on the 660-square-foot structure that'll sleep up to 10 people.
That's going to be the bunk room back there, so you can see they've started doing the drywall in there. They'll be painting it, I think, later this afternoon. Over here to your left is the actual entryway, and so there'll be a little mudroom there with a gear room and some racks for some gear.
Yestermorrow instructor Jesse Cooper says local materials and energy efficiency were key parts of the design.
Then we visited the site several times and looked at what was around there and tried to understand everything about, you know, backcountry skiers and mountain bikers and what would be an exciting thing for them to walk into.
Basics like comfortable mattresses, a propane stove, and cooktop were obvious, but he says they also wanted some fun surprises, like a corner reading nook that'll convert for sleeping and a deck that overlooks a nearby stream. This first hut cost about $60,000, paid for with a mix of grants, private donations, and membership fees. Those fees range from $35 for an individual to $65 for a family. Thompson says so far they have 186 paid members. The Green Mountain National Forest still has to sign off on the new hut's final location because it'll be on federal land. But District Ranger Chris Matrick thinks the proposed site is ideal because it's part of an existing campground and is connected to extensive hiking and backcountry ski trails.
We want to be strategic about where any proposals are put forward or any structure goes into place so that it's not, you know, creating a new recreation area where we have not desired one to be.
Vermont Huts Association already promotes a handful of other cabins in the state, but R.J. Thompson says their goal is to create a network, so they're focusing their initial expansion between Killington and Stowe. So far, he says, they've identified about a dozen prospective sites, all of which would need to undergo an extensive approval process. Unlike the larger hotel-style huts in nearby Maine and New Hampshire, which can sleep 30 to 90 guests, Thompson says the cabins in Vermont will be smaller, typically geared for 8 to 12 people, and he says all will be open year-round.
So here's where the Long Trail crosses Hadley Lane. The Ralston shelter's probably about a quarter mile south of here.
On a recent Sunday, Kate Warner of the Trust for Public Land and several other backcountry enthusiasts skied up to a remote cabin the Trust recently purchased. Vermont Huts had hoped to add it to its network. The 1,800-square-foot log home with three bedrooms and two bathrooms had stunning views, and the Trust hoped it would become the jewel of the Vermont Huts network. But the log home was destroyed in a suspicious fire last month, and Warner says it's unclear if it'll be rebuilt. Dave Kopic hopes so. He's a volunteer with the Green Mountain Club and says a thoughtfully designed hut network will encourage more people to get outside.
The name of our state is Vermont, and that is the essence of the state. And to find ways of enjoying the Green Mountains, especially the backcountry more, should be important to all Vermonters. It certainly is to me.
Jessica Savage with Vermont's Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation thinks a hut network would also set Vermont apart from other states.
We already have world-class mountain biking, but the concept that you'd be able to go long distance on primarily single-track mountain bike trails and then be able to stay in a hut where there are pots and pans, there's a stove to cook on, there's heat there. It would be really unique and really cool and definitely a big draw for visitors to Vermont.
And be a welcome economic engine for the many towns and villages along the trail. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Kack.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
More than 1,000 flights have been canceled across the United States as a major storm makes its way through the upper Midwest. The National Weather Service issued weather-related winter warnings, saying some areas could expect about a foot of snow and tough driving conditions, and schools are shut down. One of the hardest-hit areas is forecasted to be in northern Illinois. Tracy Butler is meteorologist for ABC 7 in Chicago. Tracy, welcome.
Hello there, Magna. Yes, snowy Chicago, but hey, that's what we get in the winter, right? That's what we should be expecting.
Exactly. So tell us a little bit more about what it's like in Chicago today.
Well, all morning long, you know, it has been a treacherous morning for travel, certainly around the Chicago area. This storm system started producing accumulating snow last night as people were trying to make their way home from work and from school. And so it's basically been continuing all night long into the peak time for our morning commute and at times reducing visibility to even less than a quarter of a mile. And that's a significant indication that heavy snow has been falling.
Yeah. You're right. Snow is obviously nothing unusual in Chicago. You guys can handle it. But any storm is one worth taking seriously. But do I have this right that Chicago has actually been in something of a snow drought recently?
You know what, Magna? You are absolutely right. I'm very glad that you brought that up because up until yesterday, through yesterday, we were about 9 inches below average for snowfall. So we've gone from a snow drought almost here in Chicago to, by the end of this storm, we're certainly going to be in a snow surplus. So far, we have had, just this February, we have had 7.6 inches of snow. Just February, we're only 9 days into it. And for the whole month of February in Chicago, we averaged 9.1. So we're almost getting a whole month's worth, probably, just today, maybe even.
Wow. Okay. So we mentioned the fact that there have been lots of flight cancellations because of this storm system. How are airports doing in Chicago right now?
You know what? I heard from one of our photographers who's been out there kind of monitoring some of the flight boards, mentioned that arriving flights were getting in, but there were a lot of canceled flights and delayed aircraft as well. The visibility has been a huge problem with this. And he happened to mention that there are very few people out at the airport and even no line at security. So how often do we see that nowadays, especially at O'Hare Airport here in Chicago?
Absolutely. It's great to have no line, but unfortunately, maybe you wouldn't be able to get out to fly out. So where do you expect to see this storm go?
This storm is going to continue through the afternoon in Chicago. So our afternoon and evening rush hour is going to be impacted as well, as we're still seeing winter storm warnings in effect around the area. This storm is going to continue to push on eastward as well, headed for to the Ohio Valley. But not only are we getting the snow today, but we're looking for two more punches of snow over the weekend, maybe another one overnight tonight. That one looks like it could be another 1 to 2 inches of accumulation. And then here in Chicago tomorrow night into Sunday, it's possible we could rack up maybe even another 2 to 4 inches of snow here.
Wow. Well, I trust that you'll stay warm and safe, everyone in Chicago. That's Tracy Butler, meteorologist for ABC 7 in Chicago. Thanks so much, Tracy.
Thank you.
It was sunny today where I am, but it's been awfully cold and gloomy recently. No surprise, then, that about 5% of people in the U.S. suffer from seasonal affective disorder, a form of depression brought on by the dark days of winter. Joining us now is Kelly Rowan, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Vermont, who researches seasonal affective disorder. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you.
And what is seasonal affective disorder, and how is it different from depression?
Seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, is actually a type of depression. The only thing that makes it different is the seasonal pattern that it follows, where the symptoms are in effect during the fall and the winter months, and they fully resolve or go away during the spring or the summer months. So when we're diagnosing SAD, we are, in fact, diagnosing depression. And we're looking for exactly the same symptoms that we see in depression, like feeling fatigued, sleep changes, appetite and weight changes, loss of interest in activities, difficulty concentrating, sometimes thoughts of death or suicide.
Is it about the light? Is it about the cold? Is it a combination?
It's about the light. The research is pretty clear that it's about day length or photo period. Simply the number of hours from dawn to dusk is the strongest predictor of when the symptoms begin in any given year and how bad they are on any particular day in someone that suffers from seasonal affective disorder.
Are there people who are especially susceptible?
Women are particularly susceptible, much more so than men. At least 2 times the number of women as men suffer from seasonal affective disorder. It also looks like younger adults are more susceptible, people in their 20s or their 30s. People who live at a high latitude are particularly susceptible, although it does exist in Florida. It's relatively rare compared to, for example, where I am, Burlington, Vermont.
Why are more women suffering from this than men?
That is a great question. That's the million-dollar question. Everybody reports this gender difference in seasonal depression, but nobody really explains why. In non-seasonal depression, women are more likely than men to ruminate. And this is a repetitive thinking style, focusing on the causes and consequences of your depression. This seems to make women particularly vulnerable to develop depression. Rumination increases risk of depression. It makes depression more severe when it begins. So I suspect that there's something about rumination in terms of potentially explaining the gender difference in winter depression, although that's an empirical question, and I hope somebody does the study to find out.
I imagine there are a lot of people listening to this interview thinking, well, I have that. But is that the case? Do you think that people who think they have seasonal affective disorder actually do, or that they're just a little gloomy at this time of year?
Like many things, seasonality happens on a continuum. So when we're talking about full-blown seasonal affective disorder, we're talking about the extreme of the continuum, people that have clinical depression during certain seasons of the year. And then, especially at a high latitude, there's the rest of us, people who experience some symptoms, maybe some mild energy and sleep changes, appetite changes, craving carbohydrates during the fall and the winter. Just having these symptoms at a mild threshold is not enough to say it's seasonal affective disorder. It has to be clinical depression. It has to interfere with somebody's ability to function in life and cause a lot of impairment and distress. So the bottom line, most of us can relate to this condition. It's on a continuum. Most people at a high latitude experience the symptoms to a certain extent. It's just the question of how bad is it? Is it really interfering with life?
And what kind of treatment is there for it?
Well, there's at least three treatments with a strong research base. There's light therapy, use of a device that projects bright light to the retina first thing in the morning to sort of jumpstart sluggish circadian rhythms and reset the biological clock. There's a lot of research to show that light therapy is highly effective treatment for winter depression. Antidepressant medications, the same ones that are used to treat non-seasonal depression, the SSRIs in particular, such as Prozac. There's a drug called Wellbutrin XR, which is FDA approved for the prevention of winter depression specifically. And then third, other than light therapy and medications, there's a form of talk therapy or psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral therapy that's effective in treating SAD, but also seems to be effective in preventing the return of symptoms after the treatment has ended.
And what is that? What is cognitive behavioral therapy?
Well, this is, in fact, my baby in terms of the research that I've been focusing on for the last 20 years or so. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is a tried-and-true psychotherapy for depression. It's been around since the 1960s. It's highly effective as a treatment for depression. I just happen to be the first researcher who's bothered to try applying it to seasonal affective disorder. So what it involves, if we break up cognitive behavioral, it involves working on thinking styles. In depression, thinking styles are really quite negative. We have people track their thoughts. They actually write down and record their thoughts and how their thoughts impact their mood. And then using a method called the Socratic method, we sort of gently challenge and change some of those negative thoughts to make them a little bit less negative, a little more positive, so that mood can follow suit. Mood can begin to brighten up. And then the behavioral piece of CBT involves getting people to do more activities that are fun and enjoyable. In depression, people tend to shut down. They withdraw. In seasonal affective disorder, I call it going into hibernation mode. They go home from work, get on the couch under a blanket, mindlessly watch television, which is not enjoyable, by the way, for most people who suffer from winter depression, stop answering the phone, stop doing their routines and activities that could produce a sense of relief. So in the behavior therapy side of it, we're trying to get people back in touch with things that are natural antidepressants that could provide a mood boost and help them feel better.
Why is mindlessly watching television not helpful?
Well, in seasonal affective disorder, I see this as part of going into hibernation mode. It's not like you look forward to your favorite show once a week and it really causes this great mood lift in you. It's sort of retreating into this passive hibernation state of withdrawing from people, withdrawing from activities, getting cozy on the couch under a blanket, mindlessly, passively watching television is not providing a great sense of enjoyment, in my experience, with people who have this condition.
Does it help if you have seasonal affective disorder to take a trip to somewhere warm and sunny for a few days?
Oh, it most definitely does. My word of caution about doing that has to do with reentry. So people with seasonal affective disorder uniformly say that they feel so much better when they travel to a warm, sunny location. And it's almost immediate. Within a few days of getting there, they feel great. They feel like they do in the summer. However, we have to then go back to wherever you're coming from, farther north, and that reentry can be pretty jarring for the biological clock.
So with all the research that you have done into this, does it seem like this condition has been around for a long time or that it's something new?
This condition has been around for a very long time. We can see it in the writings of ancient philosophers and physicians writing about the effects of light on mood, and even precursor to modern-day light therapy, talking about laying lethargics in the light so that we can cure their disease, which is gloom. The term seasonal affective disorder wasn't coined until 1984 by a psychiatrist by the name of Norman Rosenthal at the National Institute of Mental Health, who moved to Bethesda, Maryland from South Africa, and himself, he felt that he experienced these symptoms of depression when he made this move and put out an ad in the Washington Post, "Does anyone feel depressed?" in the wintertime. And apparently the phone rang off the wall for several days, which led him to do the initial research to find out how prevalent this problem is and eventually how to treat it with light therapy.
And the winter in Bethesda is not really even that bad.
It is not, and I know this because I moved to Burlington, Vermont from Bethesda, Maryland in 2005, and I did seasonal affective disorder research when I lived there. It's much easier to do here in Burlington, Vermont.
That's Kelly Rowan, who's a professor at the University of Vermont who researches seasonal affective disorder. Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We heard from a few people on Facebook who suffer from seasonal affective disorder. Most of them mentioned using light therapy. Jessica Mead wrote, "I have a broad spectrum light that I don't find very effective. I think the best remedy would be to move closer to the equator."
Remember the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls? It referred to the girls kidnapped from a school in the village of Chibok, Nigeria, by the militant Islamic group Boko Haram in 2014. Some of the girls did make it back, but more than 100 are still missing. And they represent only a handful of those who have been kidnapped by Boko Haram over the last decade or so.
"This is what Boko Haram told me. If you really want to get to paradise, this, they say, is such an easy thing to do."
Well, those are the words of a young girl spoken through an interpreter who managed to escape from Boko Haram. That was after she was kidnapped and sent out twice as a suicide bomber. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with the BBC's Stephanie Hegarty, who is in Lagos. She interviewed the girl after her escape.
Falmata was, which is not her real name, we're protecting her identity because of the stigma that there is against anyone associated with Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. But she was kidnapped when she was only 13 years old. She was on the way to visit her uncle in a neighboring village, and she was taken to a Boko Haram camp. And within a few months, they asked her to get married to a Boko Haram fighter, and she said no. She said she was too young. The only other option was to go on a mission, so she chose the mission without knowing what it was. And of course, that was to be strapped with a suicide vest and taken to the edge of a town and forced to walk towards the town and detonate the device. But Falmata told us she ran away as soon as she was out of sight of her captors. And as she was running, she met someone who helped her untie the vest and throw it away. She continued running. She bumped into two men, and again, they were Boko Haram. They were a different faction of the group, but they took her to their camp, and the whole process started again.
This sounds like a very brave young girl. The first sign of bravery, though, must have been refusing to marry a Boko Haram fighter. Why did she decide to do that?
She said she was too young and she didn't want to marry. Even when we met her, she was only 15 when we met her last year, and she said she was still too young to get married. So she clearly just had ideas for her future, and this wasn't it.
And yet she must have known that would have put her in danger.
She knew that it was a choice, marry or mission, and she didn't know what the mission was, but she knew she didn't want to get married. So she took the chance.
So tell me more about what happened to her after she is found a second time by Boko Haram fighters and forced into yet another mission. Obviously, she survived to tell this story.
Well, this time she knew what she was getting herself in for, so she was taken to this other camp. Luckily, the two factions didn't know each other. Otherwise, she probably wouldn't have survived, having run away the first time. And this time, when she was given the choice, she immediately said mission, thinking that she could escape again. And a few months later, she was deployed. She told us about this really interesting but quite morbid ceremony that they have before they're sent on these missions. They're painted with henna and their hair is done up nicely. They're given new dresses before they're strapped with these explosives and sent into town. Wow. So this happened to her again. And this time she was, again, as she was entering the town that she was supposed to detonate her device in, she ran away, but she ran to a neighboring village. And there she bumped into some farmers, but she said they were terrified of her. And she asked them to help her remove the device. And initially they refused, but she said it was only because they were afraid that she detonated herself that they agreed to remove it. Wow. So she had to run away from those people again. And she spent days in the bush running, trying to get back to the town where her family were. And eventually she met someone who sympathized with her and helped her find her family. She found her mother. Her father has been missing for quite a few years, so she hasn't been reunited with him.
You mentioned the stigma that comes along with being captured by the Boko Haram and having this affiliation with them, whether it was forced or not. When she was rediscovered by her family, did they take her in?
Well, her own family did. She has connections to the vigilante, which are these volunteer forces that are really intrinsic in helping defend towns and villages against Boko Haram. They work together with the army. And because she had connections there, her family were, they had the confidence, they had the, they were brave enough, I guess, to take her back. But at the moment, she's basically living in hiding. She's too afraid that neighbors or other wider family members will find out what happened to her. Mm. And will think that she's one of the militants, will think she's one of Boko Haram, because that's what generally happens. Even people who haven't been involved in something as extreme as suicide bombing, people who've just been captured, forced to marry, held as hostages for months or years, even them, when they come back, they're considered no better than Boko Haram, many of them. And it's even worse for those who come back with children, which are in the hundreds, maybe even thousands.
That's Stephanie Hegarty in Nigeria with the BBC. She's been speaking to us from Lagos about this absolutely unbelievable story of a young woman captured by Boko Haram. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Stephanie spoke with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.